When you hear the phrase, the great outdoors, what is the very first thing that pops into your head?
Well, for most people, I think it conjures up the specific image of total freedom.
Right, exactly. Running wild through a field or, exploring the
All
woods.
walls, no limits.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the ultimate playground.
It is the ultimate playground. But this is a big but.
There is always a but.
There really is. If you are raising or caring for an autistic child, that phrase, the great outdoors, can actually feel a little complicated.
It might even spike your heart rate a bit just thinking about it.
It's a paradox, isn't it?
It really is a paradox because, on one hand, it's this incredible source of joy.
And developmental growth.
Exactly. You want them to have that experience. But on the other hand, it can feel like a total minefield.
Oh,
We've
absolutely.
got safety concerns, you've got sensory overload, and then just the sheer unpredictability of, well, nature.
Nature doesn't follow a schedule.
It really doesn't. It turns a simple walk in the park into a massive logistical puzzle.
And that tension right there, that friction between the desire for freedom and the absolute necessity of safety is what we are unpacking today.
Yes, welcome to our deep dive. Today, we are looking at a comprehensive guide on safe outdoor play ideas for autistic children.
We are pulling our insights today from a really in-depth article by Angel Sense, and this was published in September 2025.
I love the framing in this source because it tackles that balance head on. The core question is really, how do you mix fun and freedom with the structure that keeps everyone safe?
And I want to be clear right from the jump. The mission here isn't to limit play.
Right, that's such a common misconception.
It is. People think safe means restricted or boring. But the goal of this research is actually to make play accessible so these kids can genuinely thrive.
We aren't just talking about burning off energy so they sleep better at night.
Although, let's be honest, that is a nice bonus.
Oh, getting them tired is definitely a huge bonus. But the source material makes it clear there's way more to it than just fatigue.
Much more. The stakes are actually quite high here. We are talking about emotional regulation.
Building complex motor skills.
Yes, and ultimately, paving the way for independence. This isn't just recess, it's a developmental laboratory.
I love that phrase, a developmental laboratory. So let's get into the why before we get into the how.
Sounds good.
What makes the outdoors so distinct for an autistic child compared to, say, just playing in a playroom or an indoor classroom?
Well, the source material calls the outdoors a living classroom. And I think that's just a beautiful way to put
The
it.
living classroom.
Yeah, think about an indoor classroom or a bedroom. It's static. The walls don't move. The lighting is usually very consistent. The floor is totally flat.
Unless you have one of those flickering fluorescent bulbs, which is just annoying for everyone.
True, true. But outdoors, it's dynamic. It is completely alive.
The wind shifts direction.
Exactly. Leaves rustle and change color.
Yeah.
The light changes intensity as clouds move across the sun.
And for a neurotypical child, that's all just background noise, right?
Yeah.
They filter it out without even trying.
They do. But for an autistic child, that environment is intense sensory exploration.
So the environment itself actually becomes the toy.
In a way, yes. That constant change stimulates curiosity naturally. It invites engagement in a way that a static room just cannot replicate.
And it really leads into the physical side of things. The source notes that, unfortunately, many autistic individuals face real challenges with physical fitness.
Yeah. Poor motor skills are a very common symptom, plus those safety limitations we already touched on.
It's hard to join a local soccer team if you struggle with social cues or if loud whistles are physically painful to you.
Right. Organized sports can be an absolute nightmare of sensory input and confusing, rigid rules.
But the outdoors encourages movement naturally.
Without it feeling like forced exercise. Even simple walking while exploring counts as a big win.
And beyond the physical benefits, the article dives into the emotional aspect. The opens totally.
For an autistic child, it helps regulate anxiety and stress. It helps them return to a calm baseline.
It shifts that nervous system from fight or flight back to rest and digest.
Precisely. And looking at the bigger picture, this is the path to independence. Being alone outside is a long-term goal for many of these kids.
Supervised play is the training ground for that future independence.
I love that perspective. It's not just play, it is training for life.
So let's actually get into the activities themselves. The source breaks these down into categories, starting with what they call sensory-friendly activities.
These seem to be the more unstructured, explore at your own pace type of things.
Yeah, these are great because they are so flexible. You can do them one-on-one or you can do them with a group,
And there's no winning or losing.
which lowers the pressure immensely for everyone involved.
And top of the list, water play.
Which, honestly, who doesn't love water play?
It's a hit for a reason. But it goes deeper than just splashing around. The source explains that autistic children often love the unpredictability of water movement combined with the predictability of its physics.
Wait, unpack that for a second. Unpredictable, but predictable.
Well, think about it. The water ripples in new ways every single time you touch it, which is highly visually stimulating. The way it catches the light is always different.
Okay, I see.
But it also reliably follows gravity. It's not like a social interaction where a person might react in a way you don't expect.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Water is safe because its rules don't change.
Exactly. It's a full sensory experience, tactile, visual, auditory, but it's fundamentally safe.
Then you have the classic nature scavenger hunt. This feels like a really great way to give a walk some actual purpose.
It is fascinating because it's a dual purpose activity. Physically, you are moving, you're hiking, climbing over logs.
But mentally, you are solving clues. You are engaging with the unknown in a very controlled way.
It anchors their attention. Instead of being completely overwhelmed by the chaos of the whole forest, they are looking for one specific thing.
Like a red leaf or a smooth, round stone.
Exactly. It filters the sensory input. It helps a child get comfortable with the fact that they don't know exactly what they'll find.
But that's okay because they have a mission.
Right. It builds cognitive flexibility.
It gamifies the uncertainty. I really like that. Now, here's one that I thought was super interesting because it just seems so basic sandbox digging.
It's similar to water play, focusing on patterns and textures, but it adds the element of heavy work.
Heavy work. That sounds like a workout.
It's a term occupational therapists use. Digging. Lifting buckets of sand, pouring them out. It heavily engages the proprioceptive system.
And that's the body's sense of where it is in space, right?
Yes. For a child who feels a little disconnected from their body, or maybe they're feeling jittery, that heavy physical resistance of the sand is incredibly grounding.
It literally calms their nervous system down.
It really does.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. But here is where I actually had my biggest aha moment reading this guide. Bubble play.
Oh, the bubbles.
I always just thought bubbles were just fun. You blow them, you pop them, end of story. But the source points out they are surprisingly useful for assessing a child's motor skills.
They are a diagnostic tool disguised as a toy. It's fascinating. Think about the mechanics of it. Can the child visually track that transparent bubble against the bright sky?
That's visual tracking.
Exactly. Can they coordinate their hands to reach out and pop it at the exact right millisecond before it drifts away?
Hand-eye coordination.
Yes. And it strongly encourages communication, too.
The source mentioned joint attention, right?
Huge for communication.
Mm-hmm.
Joint attention is when I look at the bubble, you look at the bubble, and we both know that we are sharing that exact moment.
That shared gaze is basically the foundation of all social interaction.
It really is. It's hiding massive developmental milestones inside a simple 90-cent bottle of soap.
That's just so cool. And speaking of grounding activities, we also have gardening.
The ultimate get your hands dirty activity.
The source describes this as being incredibly soothing for both the kids and the adults.
Well, think about the sensory details involved. Mm. You have the smell of the flowers, the gritty feel of the earth on your hands.
The sight of birds and insects.
And eventually, the taste of the vegetables you've actually grown yourself.
Yeah.
It really connects the child to the life cycle of their food.
And it teaches immense patience. You plant a seed and literally nothing happens for days.
Which is a very hard lesson for any child, but especially for autistic children who might really struggle with delayed gratification. Gardening teaches that good things take time.
Plus, just digging a hole in the dirt is deeply satisfying.
It's the best. And finally, in this unstructured sensory category, we have balance exercises.
Now, this felt a little bit more like a physical therapy routine, but heavily disguised as play.
It is essential therapy, though. Remember earlier we mentioned motor skills. Many autistic kids have low muscle tone or hypotonia. These exercises specifically improve core stability and cognitive functioning. The source lists specific moves you can do outside.
Like the Superman.
Yes, where they lie on their stomach in the grass and lift their arms and legs up like they're flying.
Or the wheelbarrow walk. Or even just practicing balancing on one foot.
Doing this outside, on the grass, provides a natural soft landing pad if they tip over.
Which they will.
Oh, definitely. But it also connects that intense physical effort with the fresh air. It makes the therapy feel like a game.
So that's the unstructured sensory stuff. But you can't just free play forever. Sometimes you need rules. You need clear boundaries.
And that brings us to the next major section of the deep dive, gamifying safety.
This is where we transition from open sensory exploration to structured games that secretly teach rules.
And this is so crucial for safety because the real world has strict rules. Cars stop at red lights. You can't just run anywhere you want.
Which perfectly leads into the first game they suggest, the absolute classic red light, green light.
I love this example because on the surface, it's just a fun birthday party game. But if you analyze the mechanics of it, it teaches deep impulse control.
Because you are running, your body is super excited, high energy.
I mean, you have to freeze instantly just because someone said a specific word.
And the source explicitly links this to building early road safety awareness.
It does. Stop means stop. That is a literal life-saving skill when you are anywhere near a street.
Playing this game builds that exact muscle memory in a low-stakes environment.
So that when it happens in a high-stakes environment like a busy crosswalk, the body automatically knows what to do without panicking.
That makes total sense. You're drilling the reaction safely. Then the article moves into obstacle courses, park equipment, jungle gyms, climbing walls.
Danger awareness is the key takeaway there. As caregivers, we often want to protect these kids from everything. We want to bubble wrap them.
Right, it's natural.
But they actually need to learn their own physical limits. Can I reach that monkey bar? Is this wall too high for me to jump off?
They learn to navigate physical challenges and assess risk for themselves.
Exactly. It builds coordination and spatial judgment.
Now, hopscotch. I haven't played hopscotch in decades, but the source points out it's actually a wildly complex challenge for autistic kids.
It is deceptively hard. Think about it from a motor planning perspective. First, you are jumping, which takes explosive muscle power.
Then you have to land on exactly one foot, which takes incredible vestibular balance.
And you have to straddle the area without touching the chalk lines, which requires intense spatial awareness.
It's basically a full neurological workout masking as a sidewalk game.
It really is. It forces the brain to multitask on a very high level.
And speaking of chalk lines, let's talk about chalk mazes. This is presented as sort of the artistic option.
Yes. You draw a maze on the driveway. The only real constraint is avoiding stepping on the lines.
Which forces massive concentration on balance and precise movement.
It's like a tightrope walk, but safely on the flat ground.
I love that one because you can easily make it as simple or as complicated as you need for that specific child.
Exactly. Customize it on the fly.
So we've done the solo sensory play. We've done the structured physical games. But eventually, we have to talk about the most unpredictable variable of all.
Other people.
Other people. Social play and interaction.
This is the next massive step, moving from one-on-one play with a parent to actually playing with siblings or peers.
And the source notes, that's a really big jump because parents usually adapt to the child, right? We let them win or we patiently wait for them to finish their turn.
We do. A peer, on the other hand, usually won't do that.
Not at all.
The goal here is learning to respect and cooperate with people who are not authority figures, people who have their own completely different agenda.
That introduces a whole different dynamic to the playground.
It is complex. The source suggests starting with role-based games, where the child gets to practice both giving and receiving instructions.
Or sensory bins, which are great for reinforcing the concept of sharing. Like, I use the blue shovel for a minute, then you use the blue shovel.
And team-based movement games are also excellent. They get to practice being a leader sometimes and being a follower other times.
But there is a very critical caveat here in the text. You can't just send them out into the backyard with the neighbor's kids and hope for the best.
No, absolutely not. That is a recipe for a meltdown. The source heavily emphasizes the need for an experienced adult to hover nearby.
Hovering gets a bad rap, but here it's intentional.
It is supervised socialization. You need to be right there to prevent overstimulation or mediate a conflict before it escalates into something unmanageable.
You are basically acting as the translator until they learn the language of play for themselves.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, let's pivot to the logistics of all this, because setting up all this fun actually requires a lot of behind-the-scenes work.
It really does. The source calls this section the safety net. Prep, gear, and tech.
Right, and it starts way before you even open the front door. They talk about this concept that getting there is half the challenge.
Because if the transition out the door goes badly, the entire outing is already compromised.
So mental preparation is totally key here.
Exactly. For an autistic child, a sudden, unannounced change in routine or a shift to a new environment can be devastating.
So the source suggests using visual schedules.
Yes, so they can visually see the plan laid out. First, we put on our shoes, Then we get in the blue car. Then we go to the park.
And they also mention social stories.
Social stories are brilliant. They are little narratives you read together that explain exactly what might happen at the destination.
Like, we might see big dogs at the park. We might hear other kids screaming loudly.
And critically, discussing the physical boundaries of the park before you are actually standing in the wide open space.
It's all about removing the surprise factor entirely.
Yes. Predictability is safety. And location matters tremendously, too. You want to start with low-intensity environments.
A quiet neighborhood park on a Tuesday morning, not a bustling mega playground on a sunny Saturday afternoon.
Exactly. And, oh, this is one of the best tips in the whole guide. Use visual timers to predict when it is time to leave.
Because telling a kid 5 more minutes is essentially meaningless. It's an abstract concept.
Completely abstract. But watching a red dial slowly disappear on a physical timer, that is incredibly concrete.
Transition meltdowns often happen just because the end of playtime feels sudden and unfair to them.
A visual timer makes the end predictable. It shifts the blame from the parent to the clock.
That is so smart. Now, what about physical gear? The actual tools to keep them safe?
Depends entirely on the specific child's needs. If they have balance issues from that low muscle tone we talked about, a helmet is a very smart precaution, even if they aren't riding a bike.
Just for climbing or walking on uneven ground.
Right. And if they have auditory sensitivity, noise-canceling headphones can genuinely make the difference between a fun outing and a total meltdown.
I've seen that in action. If a lawnmower suddenly starts up a block away, for some of these kids, that sound is physically painful.
It's agonizing. So headphones are essential. And of course, seeking out parks that have physical fencing around the play areas if you have access to them.
Now, we have to address the elephant in the room. The absolute worst case scenario that every caregiver dreads.
The loop one.
Wandering off. It is every parent's nightmare.
It is the terrifying reality for many. The child sees something shiny, and maybe they get scared by a loud noise, and their instinct is just to run.
They often lack that internal safety filter that says, hey, I shouldn't leave my mom.
They do. And this is exactly where technology comes in. The source mentions AngelSense assistive technology specifically for this issue.
Yeah, tell us about that. What makes it different from just, you know, sticking an AirTag in their pocket or handing them a smartphone?
Well, it's dedicated assistive technology designed specifically for this exact neurodivergent need.
Mm-hmm.
It has continuous GPS tracking, obviously.
Right.
But the key is that it gives proactive alerts when the child leaves a predefined area.
So you set up an invisible fence around the park.
Exactly. And if they cross that line, you know instantly on your phone. You aren't waiting to notice they're missing.
And there was one feature that really stood out to me in the article, the assistive speakerphone.
Oh, this is crucial. Think about the reality of an elopement. If a child is panicking or running toward a busy street, are they going to stop, pull out a phone, and swipe to answer a call?
No way. Never.
Never. But this device allows a parent to speak directly to the child, to comfort them or give them urgent instructions, even if the child doesn't touch the device at all.
It auto-answers.
Yes. You can instantly say, stop running, mommy's coming right now, or sit down on the grass.
Yeah.
In a pure panic situation, that immediate vocal connection can be everything.
That is an absolute game changer. It changes it from a desperate search mission into a rescue mission where you can actually guide them.
It provides incredible peace of mind for the caregivers, which ironically allows them to give the child more freedom.
So we've covered the why, the how, and the what. But I really want to close our deep dive today with the who.
The real-life success stories.
Exactly. The source shares some brief vignettes that prove this isn't just theoretical textbook advice. It works in real life.
These stories are so important because they really show the wide variety of what success actually looks like. It doesn't always look like joining a sports team.
Take Stefan, for example, from the article.
Right. Stefan's story is simple but very profound. He found happiness simply by expanding the range of his daily walks.
It wasn't about conquering a mountain.
Not at all. It was about pushing his personal boundary just a tiny bit further each time and finding genuine joy in being in nature. His success was just finding comfort.
And then there's the story of Sarah and Arthur.
They completely transformed their own backyard garden into a safe haven. It became a perfectly controlled space where Arthur could be totally free to explore without any hovering.
It shows that you don't need to drive to a massive national park to find that outdoor connection. You can build it right at home.
And Joshua's story is a great example of a holistic approach.
Right, the 10-year-old.
Yes. The source mentions his caregivers combine specific outdoor physical therapy routines with a specialized diet.
And the result?
He became a remarkably calm, highly independent 10-year-old, the outdoors wasn't just his recess time. It was an integral, active part of his daily therapy.
And finally, the summer camp example. This one was so cool.
Oh, this one is deeply inspiring. Autistic kids learning how to kayak together.
Kayaking is physically hard.
It is. It requires intense core balance, rhythm, and actively listening to strict safety instructions on the water.
But these kids were out there doing it and even discussing their challenges with their peers.
It brings everything we've talked about together, the physical challenge, the sensory experience of the water, and massive social growth.
It really shows what is actually possible when you take the time to provide the right scaffold for them.
It does. And that brings us perfectly back to the core synthesis of this whole deep dive. With careful planning, some creativity, and the right safety gear, the outdoors absolutely does not have to be a primary source of stress. It is a place for massive personal growth.
It's all about adapting. Every single outing is a chance to figure out what works for your child and what sparks that unique delight in them.
Exactly. And I want to leave listeners with a thought to really mull over.
Let's hear it.
The source mentions that building confidence in the outdoors is a vital step toward lifelong independence.
Right.
So ask yourself this. If we view outdoor play not just as recreation, not just as fun time to pass a lazy Saturday, but as the primary training ground for a child's future autonomy.
Wow.
How does that change the way you structure a simple afternoon in the park?
Wow.
How does that change the way you react when they stumble or when they want to wander just a little bit further?
That is a deeply powerful shift in perspective. It elevates it entirely. It's not just a playground anymore. It is literally a classroom for life.
Ideally, yes. That is the goal.
Well, that is all for today's deep dive. We really hope this information helps you find that perfect sweet spot between giving them freedom and keeping them safe. Get out there, be prepared, and let them explore. Thanks so much for listening.
Stay curious, everyone.